After his remarks, we'll switch to the panel, which will be moderated by Catherine Parks, the editor of the Diplomat. Thank you.
Today's distinguished panel of speakers participated at the high-level international conference in Samarkand under the auspices of the United Nations, which was held last week. The motto of the conference was Central Asia, Shared Past and Common Future, Cooperation for Sustainable Development and Mutual Prosperity. During those couple of days, Samarkand became the center of the world politics, without any exaggerations, I can say. It was the biggest event in Uzbekistan modern history. The forum hosted 500 to 600 participants, 250 were foreign guests from 13 countries. These were Secretary Generals of 10 international organizations, foreign ministers of 7 countries, European Union High Representative for Foreign Policy. The United States were presented by Ms. Lisa Curtis, Deputy National Security Advisor, and Mr. Andrew Ensher, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. Before switching your attention to the issues discussed in Samarkand, I'd like to emphasize that after being elected as the president, Mr. Mirziyoyev defined the region as a key priority of Uzbekistan's foreign policy. These works anticipated diplomatic breakthrough in the region. Today we live in different Central Asia than it was just 1 year ago. At present, there is a new level of political dialogue between the states of the region and increased political trust between our states. We really come close to the solution to the most acute problems that have not been resolved for years. Today we began to talk more about what unites us, and not only in terms of common history, common civilizational heritage. We divide our common history not sublimates and less focused on disagreements. So coming back to the agenda of the Samarkand Conference, I want to stress our the following. First, the development of mutual trade and economic ties. Uzbekistan President proposed to establish the Regional Economic Forum to give Central Asian business communities an open platform for direct dialogue on specific trade, economic, investment, and even innovative projects. The development of transport infrastructure and the logistical potential of our region. We have already widened our cooperation both in hardware infrastructure projects and software by creating framework for tariffs, pass-through, simplified customs, and others. Third, ensuring security and stability in Central Asia. Uzbekistan is willing to integrate Afghanistan into regional economic processes through economic reconstruction, development of those countries, transport and energy infrastructures, training its human resources. Soon, President Ghani will pay an official visit to Uzbekistan very soon. We are planning to reach $1 billion in the Uzbek-Afghan trade volume. This will be the major contribution of Uzbekistan to Afghanistan peaceful development, in our understanding. The first, and the final completion of the process of delimitation and demarcation of state borders on the margins of the Samarkand Conference, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan signed the treaty on the area of junction point of state borders. Recently, Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan agreed about 85% of their state borders, and this and thus, in fact, one of the long overdue problems have been resolved. To facilitate the implementation of above mentioned ambitious goals, Uzbekistan proposed to establish the regular consultative meetings of Central Asia leaders. Kazakh foreign minister proposed to hold first meeting in Astana. We are not talking about the creation of a new international organization of Central Asia or some other integration structure with its own charter and supranational bodies. Activities of the regional dialogue platform will be exclusively aimed at comparing notes on the key issues of regional development. This was a brief agenda of the conference and main initiatives pushed forward by the Uzbekistani government. I think the speakers on today's panels are well aware about all of it. So let me stop here and let the panel present their own view, what is going on in Uzbekistan and in the region. Thank you.
Ambassador. That was a very interesting and informative introduction. My name is Catherine Putz. I'm the managing editor of The Diplomat, and I had the pleasure of attending the conference in Samarkand a little bit over a week ago, these gentlemen here. We're going to, instead of doing the usual, everybody gets a couple minutes to talk, I think we're just going to have an open conversation about what we saw in Samarkand, some of the things the ambassador was speaking about regional development, security, cooperation, some of the changes that have taken place over the past year, and then some of the continuing challenges I think is important to address. So let's see, where shall we start? This is my first time moderating, so I can't tell. Give me a little slack, I'm doing my best. I think it's important to start with, I'd like to hear from Ambassador Herbst, John Herbst, who was the ambassador to Uzbekistan for a period of time, what your perception about the difference between your period being ambassador in Uzbekistan and what you experienced now. I think you said it had been 14 years since you'd been in Uzbekistan, so I imagine there's a little bit of a change.
There are two important things happening right now in Uzbekistan, and therefore more broadly in Central Asia. I put it that way because you need to recognize that Uzbekistan is the heart of Central Asia. It borders on all the other four post-Soviet republics. And the most important of the two, the clearest of the two, is that there is a new opening in Tashkent's relations with its neighbors. President Karimov had many virtues, but he had a deep suspicion of all of his neighbors. And that led to a certain caution in the development of regional relationships. President Mirziyoyev is much more open to the neighbors. He recognizes that, in fact, the prosperity as well as the stability of Uzbekistan requires excellent relations with the neighbors. And from the very first days in office, he reached out to his colleagues in capitals across Central Asia. And Ambassador Vahabov described some of the changes, the border agreements reached. Also very important has been the opening of trade. I was told that, for example, trade with Kyrgyzstan was up 69% this calendar year. And there's also serious discussions positive and serious discussions regarding the critical water issue in the region. So this is, I think, already apparent, and I expect more and very good things in this basket. The second area is what you might call internal liberalization, starting with the economy, but not just. And the steps here have also been clear, albeit not as firm and not as far-reaching as on the foreign side. And so I think, and I've actually was cautioned by, including senior Uzbeks, that, you know, this is important, we're making progress, but one should not be overly optimistic about what is achievable in the short run. And just one last point, as I said, this opening internally does not just refer to the economy. You have recently had the senior official from the UN responsible for religious affairs in Tashkent. You have an invitation to the UN torture rapporteur, something I had something to do with back in 2002. So these are all steps which also suggest that there's a leavening of Uzbek society.
Thank you. And so, Ilan, I know we've talked a little bit about how the conference in Samarkand fits into this overall change narrative. I'd like to share with the audience sort of how you see the conference fitting into facilitating some of this change, or at least putting some of it on display.
No, I think that's a good question. I think they're really, in sort of in the macro sense, there were two objectives sort of the conference. One was this as the ambassador said, this new convening function, the ability of Uzbekistan to play that role of being the heart of Central Asia, to really sort of bring together folks. And the second is, and this was achieved, I think, sort of resoundingly, the level of participation, in addition to all the foreign ministers of all the Central Asian states, the European Union's foreign policy czar, Federico Mogherini, was there, the Iranian foreign minister was there, there was representation from Russia and China, robust representation from the U.S. government, people were taking notice. And I think that's important in and of itself, but it's also an important validation for the Uzbek government about the fact that the changes that are taking place in Uzbekistan, the changes that have been mapped, are beginning to sort of to percolate into the consciousness of the international community. The second notion is that the conference is intended to be a jumping off point for a broader regional dialogue about integration, about the things that President Mirziyoyev has talked about, the need for greater connectivity in economics, greater connectivity in telecom and transportation links. That's a work in progress, because it's not entirely up to the Uzbek government. It's something that needs to be engaged with the other Central Asian states. On a positive note, this seems to be taking place. The foreign ministers, the consultative group of foreign ministers, as per when I left Tashkent a few days ago, was planning to meet most likely in Astana in March of next year to begin this process. So I think on the initial front, Uzbekistan as a platform, I think that job was accomplished. And I think that Uzbekistan as a sort of initiator of dialogue, that's very much in progress, but the signs are positive so far.
And at the risk of jumping around a little, I want to talk to Blaise a little bit, bring him in on the U.S. angle. So the United States is not known for paying as much attention to Central Asia as those of us Central Asians sometimes wish. So what is important about Uzbekistan for the United States? Blaise?
Well, I think there's a question of what should be important about Uzbekistan for the United States and what is currently important. And I think, you know, to jump a little bit off of Alon's points, as remarkable as it was how broad an attendance there was at this conference, how many different countries were represented and wanted to be there, signaling that they see that there is something important about the region, I think from a lot of the presentations you saw that they're not really thinking about Central Asia in its own right. Catherine, you wrote in The Diplomat, I think, very well about the presentation of the Pakistani National Security Advisor, which we don't need to go into here. But even the U.S. presentation was largely focused on Afghanistan and Pakistan and not talking about Central Asia. Federica Mogherini, the EU foreign minister, came and said the most important tenet of security for the Central Asia region is preserving the Iran nuclear deal, which, whatever you think about it, I'm not sure what its relation to the region is. The foreign minister of Iran, Zarif came and he spoke and he said the most important thing for Central Asia is making sure that the expansionist Zionist regime, I'm not sure which one he was referring to, stays out of the region. Right? So, you know, I think there's still a lot of countries that see Central Asia as an appendage to other regions or a place where other problems play out, not really a region in its own right or a place where our interests can be pursued just there. And I think that's something that hopefully this conference in Samarkand will begin the process of changing, and we'll start conversations like this one here in D.C. to start thinking about that. But I'm not sure that's really been very well formulated either in Washington or in other capitals around the world.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of looking at it. I know that I noticed that, you know, you can't have a conversation about Central Asian security without it becoming a conversation about Afghanistan. Not that that isn't a relevant thing to talk about, but I think there are security issues in Central Asia that are about Central Asia that are not about Afghanistan, and we don't really get to those. And I think some of that was actually illustrated right before our trip. I know I was in Germany when this happened. I was on vacation, and I find out that an Uzbek gentleman had driven a truck through a bike lane in New York, and suddenly Uzbekistan is in the news, and I think the American public doesn't know terribly much about Uzbekistan, and the phrase hotbed of terrorism is probably one of my least favorite things because it doesn't really tell us anything about Uzbekistan. I would like to see if you guys have any sort of reactions to the formulation of Uzbekistan, in particular in the American media, but sort of how this relation to terrorism either is a, I mean, I don't think it's a good, I don't know the word I'm looking for. I don't think it's a very good connection to make, but maybe it is, and maybe I'm wrong, and you're welcome to disagree with me. Does that conversation about the hotbed of terrorism in Uzbekistan reflect what's going on in the country and the region, or is it just sort of a thing that people say because they keep reading it in, you know, USA Today, and so they keep repeating the same thing, and they just go to the Wikipedia page and IMU, woo, and that's it.
Well, I'm happy to sort of to offer just a few thoughts. So, three things, really. The first is that as someone who spends a lot of time working on Islamic extremism sort of broadly, globally, I think there's a danger to both oversell and to underplay what's happening in the Middle East space and how it's going to affect other regions. We've had something on the order of 40,000 foreign fighters that have joined the Islamic State so far. A significant number has come from Russia and the post-Soviet space. In this particular case, Russia is sort of the central problem, much more so than the Central Asian republics. And this is where sort of the definition of Central Asia, sort of the hotbed of terrorism, which is very unfortunate, and it's something that's being parroted not only in USA Today, but there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal the day after the terrorist attack in New York, which sort of framed the same thing. Without going into the details of the fact that most of Central Asian radicalization, of the elements of Central Asia that are radicalized, are not radicalized within the borders of Central Asia. There's actually a very strong positive correlation between Uzbek migrant labor, for example, that goes to Russia, and the radicalization there, and then the transition to the Middle East, right? This is a dynamic that institutes like the Royal Institute for Policy Studies in London is working on. But it sort of bears noting because it suggests that the problem is not internal to Central Asia. It's adjacent to it, but it's not internal to it. But that doesn't mean that it's not an issue of concern for Uzbekistan. And this is why I think it's necessary to understand what's happening in Tashkent and the policy rethink that's taking place, not only in security terms. Because for Uzbekistan, economics is security. The stronger, more stable the Uzbek economy is, the less and the more jobs there are, the less need there is for a massive migrant force to leave the country. Meaning that there are less Uzbeks who are prone to radicalization beyond the border. So I think it's necessary to understand this policy strategy, and it's really a sort of a five-pronged one, right? Everything from administrative to legal reform to economic reform to human rights reforms to foreign policy. And again, right, we're in the early days, and this is sort of all uneven, but it is not all separate. It is connected, and we have to understand how this all links up to the things that we tend to care most about, which is security.
Sure. If I could just build on that, I think there is also an interaction between this new policy of openness that Ambassador Herbst described and this issue of radicalized Uzbeks who might not be in Uzbekistan and trying to figure out how you address the internal security. So on the one hand, You have migrant labor that could be radicalized and returning to Uzbekistan, so you have to deal with that issue. You have an Islamic State that is includes Uzbek nationals that is on the run and might be looking to move to new places. And so there is the potential, even if there's not radicalization happening within Uzbekistan, there is the potential for radical elements to come back in. So there's definitely a security question for Uzbekistan related to that. And then there's a question of if there is going to be greater openness in the region, whether that is through opening of borders, easier transport, is there greater movement for some of these individuals to come back? But there's also the question of, as perhaps the regime's security apparatus relaxes its hold on society, what does that do in terms of creating new opportunities for radicals to take hold? And I think this is something Ilan and I had the chance to meet with a number of senior religious officials, including the senior mufti and the chairman of the Religious Affairs Board. I think there's an interesting balance right now being struck in Uzbekistan between taking a security-centric approach to dealing with Islamic extremism, where there's members of the security apparatus who attend Friday prayers, who make sure that that people do not linger at the mosque, there aren't large groups congregating, who do take a very sort of hands-on approach, which leads to concerns about religious freedom and other issues. But they're also trying to start, I think, creating and crafting their own national religious identity that's much more focused on a Sufi, moderate Islamic heritage that Dr. Fred Starr has done a lot to excavate and unearth in his book, The Lost Enlightenment. They're creating a new center for Islamic civilization in Tashkent. There's several new Islamic schools being created throughout the country. And if those two elements, sort of the security element, but also the ideological element, can be appropriately moderated so that one starts to be relaxed as the other takes hold, then it would be a very positive story for Uzbekistan and the region. But if that ratio is wrong for whatever reason, it could go the other way, right? If the security apparatus doesn't relax enough, the oppression could lead to more radicalization. If it comes off too soon, then you could have the openness leading to more radicalization as well. So while the story might not be a hotbed of terrorism, I don't think it's an entirely separate issue from what is happening in Central Asia right now.
Yeah, I think that's particularly interesting, especially on the sort of ideological, as you termed it, more of the religious education angle. I think when you see a lot of these folks who commit these acts of terror, their education basis in Islam is not the highest. So it's easier to mislead somebody who doesn't know their own faith very well. And so I think if you have as you said, you have a security approach and you have a softer societal approach, it kind of have to measure these things at the same time. Any thoughts, Ambassador?
I think that ignorance about Uzbekistan's default mode in the United States and more broadly in the West, there is a problem with Islamic extremists in Uzbekistan, but it's been exaggerated. And the fact that you've had several spectacular incidents involving Uzbek nationals has fed this exaggeration. But on balance, the problem of extremism within Uzbekistan has been kept largely under control. And the more visible problem has been Uzbeks fighting in Afghanistan and now in Syria and in Iraq. And these incidents in capitals of various places around the world. But it is over, it's been exaggerated.
Yeah, I was actually looking at these numbers the other day for an article I was working on. Sort of these three terrorist attacks in 2017 were perpetrated by Uzbeks, the New Year's attack in Istanbul, Stockholm truck attack, and then New York, out of 1,600 terrorist attacks that were logged in this open source database I was looking at. So if you think about sort of the scales, it's a little bit different than the biggest problem I think in terrorism. So let's move on to a little bit rosier topic. I don't know. Let's talk about sort of regional cooperation. So I think it's interesting that Uzbekistan's sort of re-engagement has opened, I think, elevated a lot of hopes of a lot of folks in the region for cooperation. But at the same time, you have this problem on the Kazakh-Kyrgyz border, and I think that illustrates some of the difficulties in this sort of personality-driven politics that you still have in Central Asia. So what kind of challenges do you think there are for greater regional cooperation. There's certainly the desire there. Everybody wants more cooperation. It's good for economies. It's good for people. But there have been obvious reasons for why it has not worked in the last decade or so. And so how do you overcome some of these either longstanding problems between states or just sort of functional issues in trade and things like that?
Well, let me start by saying that to me it's all about transportation. I think what you're looking at is a region that has historically been siloed. It's been sort of isolated. The countries have been isolated from one another. This has been a byproduct of fairly stagnant national policies among the Central Asian states, but it's also, let's be clear, has been something that has worked in the benefit of external powers like Russia that are very interested in sort of keeping the grouping divided, sort of keeping sort of the countries unaligned. The way you begin to reverse that is you begin to allow them to talk to each other without intermediaries. And the way you can do that is you have to be able to get from here to there. And so the positive steps, and also very early steps, you know, the fact that there's now a direct air link between Dushanbe, Tajikistan, and Tashkent, is a very positive development, but it's less than a year old. The fact that there are train links between Tashkent and Astana is a very positive development, also very new. But the more these things build, the more they grow, the more there's resiliency in that independent dialogue that the Central Asian states should be crafting. And by the way, the easier it is to move around the region, the easier it is for foreign businessmen to move around the region. And this is a not insignificant secondary aspect of the sort of the larger strategy. It's very hard to envision regional integration in an economically robust way if it's very hard to move around. The easier it is to ship goods, to transport goods, the easier it is to have a serious, sustainable discussion about foreign direct investment, the way Uzbekistan is beginning to talk to the West about. So I think, to me, it's all about this. It's all about sort of breaking those shackles of sort of being the stovepipes of the past, and beginning to figure out how to move around the region better.
How do you think you can sort of institutionalize some of these changes that have made? Because I think if you look at the trajectory, a lot of this sort of resurgence of cooperation occurred after the death of Islam Karimov, because he kind of stood in the way a lot of those initiatives, sort of these personal relationships around the region. But on the other hand, this also means that a lot of these changes can be sourced personally to the president, so it's still a very personality-driven change. How do you institutionalize some of those changes so that you can continue to trade when, you know, a leader has a tiff with another leader? How do you kind of shift the Central Asian model away from the personality-driven politics?
Well, I don't know that I'll have the answer. I think Ambassador Herbst might have the answer, a better answer. But I would only offer this idea that it is certainly an initiative that started that's personality driven. But the more international trade agreements, the more sort of legal conventions, multilateral conventions among the states, the more this is sort of institutionalized, the less personal it becomes, and the easier it becomes for other external actors, you know, Russia, China, the European Union, the United States, to buy in to this notion that the region is becoming more interconnected.
I would hesitate to say that the changes we've seen in Uzbekistan over the past 15 months are personality driven. One of the interesting things, which is not well understood about the country, is that there is a rather cohesive elite, and that that cohesion suggests, I won't say unanimity or necessarily consensus, but a sense among key actors about what's important, what needs to be done next. When I was in Tashkent last week, I had a chance to speak with people and commented on how quickly President Mirziyoyev came out of the box, even as interim president. I was told that, in fact, the things that he'd done were recognized by important folks in Uzbekistan as something that was necessary for the country. So it's not as if he was a lone cowboy out pushing something all by himself. So that's point one. Point two is, it picks up on what Alon said, which is that you already are seeing the codification of these changes in agreements with the neighbors. And obviously, no agreements are forever. And any country can back away from them as it takes, something we're rediscovering again here in Washington. But it is a barrier, the fact that you have agreements, to walk away from. It's a barrier to removing these changes. So I am confident that what we're seeing in the region, the opening of relations, is something which is going to persist. It can always be changed, but I think, you know, given Uzbek political culture, what we're seeing represents not just the views of one man.
Sure. If I can add maybe a different element to that, you know, it struck me as really interesting that at this conference in Samarkand, which was about regional cooperation, it was really about the five Central Asian republics working together, there was 13 other nations represented, from Latvia to South Korea to the United States, Japan, Iran, India, Pakistan. Why is that? Why do you need all these other countries to talk about how the five countries are going to work together? And I think that's because there's concern, and rightfully so, that there needs to be international buy-in for there to be regional cooperation. It's very easy for any one of the five Central Asian countries to sort of be picked off by an external power, especially when you sort of have Russia and China looming on either side. Ambassador Herbst, I think, gave a very, very powerful speech about this in Samarkand that I don't want to steal his thunder, but maybe he'll reprise some of his points. But I do think having the engagement and balance and buy-in of a broad international coalition is also important, right? Because if, for whatever reason, external powers think that greater cooperation, greater awareness within the region is not in their interest, then, you know, it's very easy for them to upset the apple cart by just sort of meddling in one or two of the five. And so, in addition to the internal and the political and the regional impediments, I do think this international one needs to be recognized as well. And I thought that was one of the achievements of the Samarkand conference, that it wasn't just, you know, the five foreign ministers talking to each other, that it really was looking to get this international buy-in.
I think that's a very sort of prescient point on sort of the international buy-in in order for there to be regional cooperation. I don't know if anybody else picked up on this, but there was only one Chinese speaker. I thought it was a very light footprint. The One Belt and One Road was mentioned favorably by a number of speakers. I think Ms. Ilya used the favorite Chinese phrase, win-win. I'm just interested in your thoughts on the sort of the Chinese angle on Central Asia. I think there's a lot of cooperation efforts in terms of infrastructure development and those kinds of things, but it's interesting that there's sort of, it seemed at least in the context of the Samarkand conference, sort of a little bit of a Chinese stand back. And I have my read on that, which is, you know, any level of greater transportation links in Central Asia benefits the Chinese vision for the region. So there's no need for a heavy hand on the part of Beijing, because this is going to happen without their pushing, and it's probably best to happen without the overt pushing. But I'd be interested in sort of your take on how Central Asia and China sort of fit together in both of their regional initiatives.
Happy to take a stab. So I think that's right as far as it goes, but I think it would be a mistake not to recognize that the modest showing by China was actually a calculated decision by Uzbekistan. In the conference itself, on the sidelines, in governmental meetings that I've had during this visit and previous visits, I think it was very clear that the Uzbek government understands the potentially all-consuming nature of the One Belt, One Road initiative. I've spent some time myself out in Western China, and I've sort of seen at least sort of what the macro plan looks like. It looks like a lot of investment, looks like many belts, many roads, with probably less regard for sovereignty among the constituent states that are supplicants than would be expected. And I think the fact that Uzbekistan, in the foreign policy component of the Mirziyoyev strategy, is looking more and more at balancing in the context of Afghanistan, but also balancing in terms of trade, balancing in terms of international relations, that's not an accident. There is trepidation about the fact that if these other areas of foreign policy aren't cultivated, Uzbekistan runs the risk of maybe not being gobbled up by the One Belt, One Road, but certainly being adversely affected by it. And I think it's something that other countries in the region, like Kazakhstan, for example, actually are in far greater danger of, or Kyrgyzstan. But nonetheless, it is a concern, and my sense was that was reflected in the staffing for the conference and the amount of Chinese official representation.
Right now, I think you'd have to say that the external power with the greatest influence in Central Asia is Russia. But there's no question that China is looming more and more, not just as a competitor to Russia, but actually as the successor to Russia in Central Asia. They both adjoin the region, but China has an economic dynamism which Russia does not. And that was apparent when I was in Tashkent 15 years ago. It's even more apparent today. Growing Chinese influence in Central Asia, including Uzbekistan, is virtually guaranteed. But Alana's right that policymakers in Tashkent pay close attention to power. Military, economic. And they recognize both the more immediate danger from Moscow, but the longer range challenge from Beijing. And they take steps in order to offset this. One such step is to make sure they have a better relationship with the EU and with the United States. And I would expect Tashkent to continue to pursue a variety of policies designed to guarantee their ability to make sovereign decisions in the wake of a rising China.
I just want to pick up real quick on your point about the EU. That was something that I noticed, that there seemed to be a focus on the EU and the UN as kind of core partners in this cooperation effort. I think because they're further afield, have fewer I think political interests, but do have economic interests. Is that something you noticed, or?
Well, what I noticed in Samarkand was the shrewd organizing by the Uzbeks to attach the Central Asian meeting with the foreign minister of the EU to the UN conference. Mm-hmm. So they got synergy and a much bigger bang for their buck.
Yeah, I think so. Any thoughts, please?
Yeah, I mean, just to your point about President, you know, Joyce's use of the term win-win, you know, as Alon pointed out, transportation infrastructure is critical to the region, and insofar as One Belt, One Road is about building rail and road and other links, then that there is win-win, right? But does the project extend beyond that is I think the question for Uzbekistan and all of us to ask ourselves, and is there sort of additional goals that the Chinese are going to be trying to accomplish as they sort of expand outward this infrastructure links. Might be too early to tell, but I think it's also not a given that this is just about infrastructure and it's an easy win-win for everyone involved.
All right. I have, I think, one more question I'm going to pose to the panel, and then I think I'm going to jump a little bit early to the audience, because I can do that. I'm the one with the microphone. My sort of final question, a phrase that I definitely use a lot in reference to Uzbekistan is cautious optimism. I know it sometimes frustrates some of my Uzbek friends because they ask me, why cautious? Why can't you just be optimistic? So I'd be interested, where do you fall on the optimism to pessimism scale with regard to Uzbekistan and its cooperation efforts, first? And then second, sort of how... What needs to be done on the part of Uzbekistan to move you closer to optimism? I think on my part, you have, you know, very positive moves in terms of regional cooperation and economic efforts, but you also see some of the hurdles, especially on the sort of human security angles. You still have reports of forced labor and cotton in some regions. You still have some journalists who've been detained. So, you know, at the same time, you have what is it, 1,600 people taken off the blacklist, you have a writer who returns and he's immediately arrested. So I think there's sort of, it's a two steps forward, one step back kind of thing. Not that we can necessarily expect anything better. I think that's my sort of final question is, you know, if someone had asked you a year ago what opening and progress in Uzbekistan would realistically look like, is this what it would look like? Or is there something better that Uzbekistan can be doing?
So I think, generally speaking, cautious optimism is exactly sort of where I would end up also. I think on the foreign policy front, it's sort of full-blown optimism in the sense that you're seeing a dynamism that really hasn't existed in the region before. Again, early days, there are external actors that have other ideas. I think the key for the United States is not to have a strategy for Central Asia, but to allow the Central Asian states to talk, to integrate, to sort of foster, empower these sort of discussions. There's hope in some quarters that countries like China and Russia will do it. But that's not the sort of the squeaky wheel. I mean, to me, I think you're absolutely right. Look, this is early days in the sort of domestic dimension of the strategy and for Uzbekistan and also for the long-term viability of a strategic partnership with the United States, the domestic dimension is what matters. Mm-hmm. So cautiously, very optimistic that Uzbekistan is demonstrating the ability to hear sort of dissenting views in a way that it wasn't before, the ability to be open to delegations from Human Rights Watch, to the UN Human Rights Ombudsman in a way that they weren't before. This is all steps in the proper direction. There's a lot of steps that still need to be taken, but for how early we are in this process, I think this is the right track.
I would agree largely with the law. The foreign policy opening is for real and it's going to bring positive things for Uzbekistan and for the region. The Tashkent has always been interested in a closer relationship with Washington. And they've had that in part based on security interests, especially after 9/11 when I was in Tashkent, but also more recently with the Northern Distribution Network. But given the idiosyncrasies of American policy, that is not enough to sustain the type of relationship that they would like. And to truly have that better relationship, there will have to be significant progress, significant change on human rights-related issues. And I think that is possible, but it's also true that there is a style of governance in Uzbekistan which makes that not so easy to achieve. They would have to reform the way they do business, the way they think about security, for this to be successful. And so that's an important point. And then there's a third point, which is as important. And I touched on this before, but not as fully as I will now. The clear but still small steps we've seen in Uzbekistan on economic liberalization have to be turned into large steps. The Uzbek people historically have been great merchants. So the talent in country to create a thriving economy with less central control than has been the norm is large. If the authorities, in a sense, have faith in their people and are able to manage the very still powerful vested interests in the country, there can be an economic mural in Uzbekistan which would power great transformation. But on this point, I remain very cautiously optimistic.
So I have the difficult task of finding a way to say the exact same thing as Alain Ambassador Herbst in a new and novel way, because I agree completely with them. Like them, you know, I share the optimism about what's happening in regional cooperation, some of the steps on economic liberalization, and concern that, you know, we do not take for granted that economic liberalization automatically means political liberalization, right? I mean, I think we, Chinese model, a whole number of countries that have tried to use economic liberalization as a way to avoid having to loosen their grip on power. That's very much not what we'd like to see happen in Uzbekistan. Maybe to put a different spin on it in terms of what I'd like to see, just reflecting on some of the conversations I had with individuals, members of the Uzbek government and others, I noticed a very distinct generational gap between individuals that I talked to for whom stability was the watchword, color revolutions were, and foreign interventions causing color revolutions was the enemy, and who were very slow to embrace the political liberalization aspect of President Mirziyoyev's reform agenda. One quoted to me half of Winston Churchill's famous quote that democracy is the worst political system, and forgot the clause that follows. And a younger generation that really seemed to be optimistic, energetic, and ambitious in carrying out this agenda and what it meant for their country. Over time, what I'd like to see is a transition to that to that viewpoint of the younger generation, and hopefully that will achieve all of the things that Ilan and Ambassador Herbst outlined.
Excellent. All right. So I assume everybody's got some good questions. I hope so. I see some friends who should in the audience. So who'd like to go first? Anybody? Navahor wants to go first.
So I'm Navahori Mamua from the Voice of America. It's wonderful to listen to all of you. So all of you have talked about how Uzbekistan is misunderstood, not well known, maybe ignored in many ways, not just in the United States, but in the wider Western world. What could the government of Uzbekistan do at this point so that its concerns are understood, its issues are understood here specifically? Obviously, the fact that all of you were invited and hosted by the Uzbek government in Samarkand says that they are trying to engage. What could they do? What kind of concrete steps they could take so that people know about it here in Washington specifically?
I think that's an interesting question, and I think the answer, and not just for Uzbekistan, for any foreign nation that's sort of interested in sort of gauging the temperature in Washington, is to first determine what language Washington is speaking. So during the Obama era, there was a very large concern about delegation of authority, right? Deputies, security deputies in places like North Africa and in Europe and as well. In the case of the Trump administration, there is a very healthy appetite for developments, sort of structures that empower American business, American trade, American economic investment in a way that it doesn't empower others. So I think in this particular case, Uzbekistan is sort of navigating a very interesting interesting road where if they present the proper pitch to Treasury, to Commerce, to sort of to other appendages of the U.S. government, there will be a very healthy response about the fact that Uzbekistan is opening. Here's the opportunity to get in on the ground floor of something that could be big, maybe big. And by the way, through your investment, you could help guarantee that it will be big. I think that's a message that's very well received, would be very well received in Washington currently.
I would agree with Ilan that if you're talking about the Trump administration, demonstrating that you are open for business will bring wanted attention. But to pick up on something I've already referred to, if you want to have the broader relationship with the United States, which will be long-lasting, you also have to address the human rights concerns. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the UN torture rapporteur is going to Tashkent is a good thing. I think it's highly likely if he does his job, he'll issue a very negative report, which is not necessarily a problem, as long as the government responds to that negative report in the proper way. And if steps are taken that are seen as easing human rights difficulties, the number of people in jail who are in jail for reasons of what they believe, although, to be fair here to Uzbekistan, at least in my time, and I believe this is still true, the overwhelming majority of those in jail are, in fact, extremists. But you can deal with extremists not just by locking them up. So steps taken in this area, I suspect, would provide the basis for a closer, long-term relationship between Washington and Tashkent, which is in the interest, I think, both of the Uzbek and the American peoples.
Just maybe to add an element in terms of issues the Trump administration cares about, another is the issue of Islamist extremism, and to the extent that Uzbekistan itself is grappling with how to deal with this issue and coming up with a more human-centric model that is focused on the development of, you know, the new Islamic Civilization Center, sort of new schools of Islamic study, being open to being a partner for the United States. And, you know, no one wants to necessarily be a model or sort of the moderate Muslim partner, but being part of the conversation that the Trump administration wants to have about how you limit extremism would be another valuable resource. But I would echo Ambassador Herbst that, you know, the administration is not the only and the most important partner in terms of managing the relationship with the United States. And if you can sell yourself to the administration but still have friction with sort of civil society and other organizations in the United States, that relationship is always going to remain problematic.
Yeah, I think one important sort of angle is engagement with the Uzbek community in the United States. I think a lot, there's 5,500, something like that, Uzbek-born nationals who are in the U.S. And so I think engaging with those communities is one way to help deal with the kind of conditions and sort of mental state that the gentleman who plowed a truck into people in New York did. Is sort of the community, I think, has a lot of weight it can lift in terms of taking care of its own, but also in terms of publicizing where is Uzbekistan, what is Uzbekistan, what's awesome about Uzbekistan. And I think that goes a long way to easing that familiarity gap that leads to a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of just sort of stereotyped responses. So tourism is great. Yay. All right, next question. Gentleman in the back.
So thank you very much for the discussion. I'm wondering if there was any discussion of the Eurasian Economic Union and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization at this event.
There was a little. I'll throw it to you guys, but I thought it was an interesting, I think these days, especially with what's going on between Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, the EU is having a low moment.
I think that's right. So yes, there was, but I think there was also a sort of a very quiet understanding that, at least from the Uzbek side, from the convening side, that the Eurasian Economic Union is not the economic model that is most attractive to Uzbekistan to foster growth. And I actually think that was reflected. We talked a little bit about the Chinese representation at the conference. The Russian representation at the conference was, I think, also sort of very indicative of this. The Secretary General of the SEO did speak, right? So there is a recognition of the role, the sort of the forcing function that Russia plays sort of through constructs in the region, but that wasn't the focal point. And most of the Russian presence at the conference was actually academic in nature. It was dealt with discussions of economy, discussions of organized crime, discussions of sort of radicalization, things like that. Very constructive, but not dispositive. Not dispositive in the sense that there was an indication that Tashkent is sort of looking exclusively or even overwhelmingly northward. And I actually think that's a very positive thing. Sort of the vibe, the general vibe I got was that the Eurasian Economic Union needs to be, and sort of Russian concerns generally need to be considered. They need to be taken into account, right? You can't fake geography. But at the same time, that is not the preferred avenue of development.
All right.
Anybody else? Earlier, there was a discussion. Mohammed Sahib, by the way, from Radio Free Universities. Earlier, there was a discussion about how much of the current changes are personality-driven changes in the light of the even earlier decisions taken by Karimov to remain isolated is also similarly a personality driven in many ways. Now the Mirziyayev, the fact that Mirziyayev isn't even traveling on Uzbek Airlines and borrowing his airplane from someone from in Moscow, and he's touching many things, but he isn't touching the core problem, which is security. What does this tell you in terms of his own stability of his own regime?
Questions about regime stability?
I'm going to
pick off on this one.
I suspect that you will continue to have stability in Uzbekistan. There was a fair amount of hair pulling back in the early aughts about the stability of the regime, which was actually completely not based on reality. And the fact that you had a quick and a stable transition after President Karimov died is another indication of that stability. I'm not certain what to make of President Mirziyoyev's taste in airplanes. I think it's an interesting fact. It may portend something significant, but I'm not certain of that. I do believe, based in part on my experience there and in part on the conversations I had over the past 10 days, that there is no new opening in Tashkent towards Moscow. There may be a personal connection between President Mirziyoyev and Alisher Osmanov, which might explain this. But beyond that, I would not assume that Usmanov is a stalking horse for the Kremlin, although he's obviously pretty close to very powerful people in Moscow.
I mean, the one comment that I would add, something that I found particularly interesting, was that it was repeated to us a number of times that there is no cult of personality when it comes to Karimov in Uzbekistan, and yet we were taken to the mausoleum of Karimov, where there was an imam who led a prayer to the memory of Karimov, as well as I could tell. And I once made the mistake of using the term to one of our Uzbek interlocutors of this reform agenda being a radical transformation, and that caused a lot of consternation, saying, no, this is a continuation of what was already happening under the previous regime. And so I feel this need to couch this as a continuity, and yet be concerned about creating a cult of personality. There's definitely a tension there that the regime is walking. Whether that's indicative of issues with stability or not, I'm not sure, but there is an interesting dynamic there.
Actually, if I could jump in, Uzbekistan is a conservative society. And so it's not surprising, even if they're going off in new directions, they want to stress continuity. To illustrate the point from a different place, in Saudi Arabia, when I think it was King Abdulaziz wanted to introduce telephones into the kingdom, and there was opposition from the clerical establishment, what he did was he had the very first phone call used to have someone read from the Quran. So it's actually smart politics to present a policy of change as, in fact, continuity.
Interesting point, politics of sort of, this is continuity even if it's not sort of it's a politically neutral kind of thing to do, so it doesn't upset the apple cart, as I think you mentioned earlier.
Hello, my name is Roxana. I'm a research intern with the Hudson Institute. I have two questions. You talked about how Central Asia was seen as more of an appendage rather than a region of its own right. So can you mention more about how it can play, or the role it can play as a region on its own right? If you can mention a couple of those, because you mostly talked about Pakistan, Afghanistan, but not necessarily as a region on its own right. And my second question has to do more with China. Ambassador Herbst, you mentioned how China may even become a successor in the future. Can it become a security guarantor, as Russia is right now? Can it play that kind of role, or do you mean just successor in terms of economic provisions? What about security? Thank you.
It's actually pretty simple. Military power is ultimately based on economic might. And China has a dynamic economy, and there's no reason to assume that their growth is going to stop, although I think we can expect it to slow down. Russia is basically a hydrocarbon economy. One of the great tragedies of contemporary Russia is that they have such extraordinary human potential. Great minds in mathematics and science, And that has not translated into a dynamic economy. Unless there's serious economic change, reform in Russia, it is going to fade. Even before the drop of oil prices in 2014 and before the sanctions imposed for Russian aggression in Ukraine, Russian economy only grew in 2013 by 1%. 1%, and oil is over $100 a barrel. Unless there's serious change, Russia is going to become economically weaker, it's going to fall behind as China becomes economically stronger. And the Russian security role in Central Asia, anywhere, is going to diminish. I'm not predicting that because I think that ultimately there'll be changes in Russia. But if not, China will certainly supplant it, including in the security sphere, if, here again, we're into fortune telling, if the countries of Central Asia do not prosper. And this leads to your first question. It's a failure of geopolitical imagination in capitals all around the world that the importance of Central Asia is not understood. Central Asia is the center of Eurasia, the center of what Mackinder, the English geographer from 100 years ago, called the Great World Island. Central Asia has at times been a center of not just world culture, but world power. And you have a very unusual situation today, which is potentially dangerous, of a relatively weak area, Central Asia, surrounded by two great powers, Russia and China, and a host of other large regional powers, Iran, which also borders the region, Pakistan and India. And So Central Asia could be evacuated. And it is very much in the interest of global stability, and for that matter, the United States, and for that matter, the EU, that it not be treated as a vacuum into which these neighboring great powers are sucked. This could lead to very serious instability beyond Central Asia. And that's why the United States, have an important, if not critical, interest there. I think you can make a case for being critical. The prosperity and stability of Central Asia is of great importance to us. And we don't want there to be a war between China and Russia in Central Asia. I'm not predicting it, but it could happen. And we don't want one of those powers to suddenly become dominant in the region.
I think that's exactly right. And I would actually point out, right, if you're being completely intellectually honest, this is a very new cycle for the United States when it comes to Central Asia. We've historically looked at the region as a buffer for narco trafficking, for Islamic extremism, an arena of competition with regard to energy, right, and sort of what some scholars around town have called the new gray game. But we haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about the region as a region in its own right. What do the peoples want? Sort of what are the cultural links? How do we get them to where they want to go? And I think the most constructive place where this administration and the next one can be is actually beginning an earnest conversation on that front. We've spent far too long, and we, you know, our counterparts in Moscow, our counterparts in Beijing, spent far too long talking about here's what we want to do by, with, and through Central Asia. This is sort of how we want to use the region for our geopolitical goals. We don't spend a lot of time, not nearly enough time, thinking about how a prosperous Central Asia can benefit us. Right? I mean, it's a completely different conversation, and it's one that we really aren't having yet. But as we're seeing, right, the changes in the region suggest that we should at least start thinking about that new relationship.
Yeah, I think on the regional aspect, I think there's the most important role is going to be played by the Central Asian states themselves. And I think working on the border issues, working on water resource issues, are very regional issues. And I think through those, that's where you start to see the formulation of a coherent region. If it isn't now, that's how you get there. Opinion.
Blaise, any thoughts? Yeah, I think the short answer I would give is I'd like to see the region be well ordered and a member of the international order, right? I mean, I think increasingly we talk about sort of the erosion of or the campaign against the liberal international order and everything that the U.S. tried to build after World War II, extend after the end of the Cold War, is now on shaky footing in terms of having states that are strong and sovereign and members of an international trading community, but also respective of of civil rights at home. As Ambassador Herbst Alon said, having Central Asia join that club, be a part of that order, would be good for Central Asia, and would be good for the rest of the world. And so in some ways, I think our goal should be for Central Asia not to be an issue. I don't know, we've talked about how Central Asia has been ignored. There's maybe not enough conversations in Washington about Central Asia. It'd be great for there not to be too many conversations about Central Asia in Washington, too, because that just means there's something wrong, right? But for a strong and vibrant region that is doing well in and for itself, not a satrapy of another great power not being used for other purposes in the long side.
In the back.
It's a bit of a long one, so please bear with me. I worked at the U.S. Embassy in Dushanbe, Tajikistan, for several years, and what I found appalling is how, while the U.S. Voices concerns with human rights violations in the region, at the same time channels millions and millions of dollars to the governments of Central Asia to help keep the region stable. And the way it manifests itself in Tajikistan in particular is that the Tajik government uses the weaponry, the training that the U.S. provides the government to then suppress political dissent in the country. And I've had this conversation with a lot of U.S. diplomats, and the most honest answer I've received about the sitting conflict in the U.S. foreign policy goals in the region is that U.S. will do certain things to sort of uphold the human rights record in the region, but at the end of the day, it's going to make stability in the region the highest priority of whatever it takes. And I guess my question to you is, do you think it's possible for the U.S. foreign policy to reconcile the seemingly conflicting goals of both upholding human rights record at the same time keeping the Central Asian governments stable without them violating human rights?
I think that's an interesting and a good question. So the securitization of diplomacy, kind of the prioritization of all politics is sort of the ranking of priorities, and you need to kind of put one at the top. So thoughts on how you bring maybe some balance and some sense to that, because it does sometimes feel a little contradictory to push sort of a democracy message, and then we can count the number of sort of free and open election in Central Asia with one finger as of like 2 months ago. So it's sort of, how do you reconcile these things in American foreign policy?
I think that's an excellent question. It's a fair question. I think the sort of the candid answer, and my panelists may disagree, but I think the candid answer is that if we are forced to choose, we always default to this idea of the region as it's helpful for us to do certain things, security, counter-narcotics, and sort of all this stuff. The key is for the Central Asian states to be dynamic enough that we don't have to choose. And that's actually why, sort of, where the optimism in the cautious optimism grade comes in when it comes to Uzbekistan. Because when you see governments in the region beginning on their own to do things that square that circle, that begin sort of opening up discussions of the human dimension, that begin sort of devolution of political authority down from the presidency down to other institutions, and even down to, in the future, to the governor level, which is planned in Uzbekistan, it eliminates at least some of that cognitive dissonance, because American officials can feel better about investing in governments that they see are tangibly moving in a direction in democratic and governmental terms that they support, rather than being forced to choose, do we support or not support this regime when they're not making any progress? So I'm, again, cautiously optimistic that this is sort of the era that we're entering into. It's not the era where we were before, where we had to make those choices. And when you have to make those choices, security inevitably wins out. But now, we can at least envision a discussion in the near future where we're not actually making that binary choice.
I agree that it's a good question, but I think that there's an assumption in your question which is challengeable, which is not quite right. It's not a simple choice sometimes between security and human rights. Let me give you an example. The Shah of Iran ran an authoritarian regime, and for years and years before he fell, in 1979, people would slam him for his human rights violations. And they would criticize the United States for supporting him. When crunch time came, as the Khomeini Revolution gathered steam, the United States did not provide the sort of support to the Shah that might have kept him in power. I say might have, I don't know if it would have worked. But there's no doubt that the human rights abuses in the Ayatollah's Iran were far greater than those in the Shah's Iran. And I think it's safe to say that the security support we provide, whether it's to Tajikistan, to Uzbekistan, is at least partly motivated to make sure that Islamic extremism does not prevail in Central Asia. And when I was in Tashkent, and even as ambassador, and even today, I've not been shy about pointing out problems with human rights practice in Uzbekistan. But that does not mean that I believe that we should not be providing security support. Because again, you can criticize the regime under Karimov or now, but their practices are not nearly as bad as what you would see if the IMU or the IJU came into power in Uzbekistan. So we need to understand that. And so, especially in the human rights community, there's a blindness to what I've just said. In fact, the human rights community has distorted discussion of human rights problems in Uzbekistan. I criticized them too back when I was in office and since. But we need to understand that life is complicated. And the fact that someone may not be a good guy does not mean that his opponent is a good guy. And there are regimes that are not particularly nice, which if they fall, would be followed by something worse. And we've seen that happen.
Perhaps just to build on what Ambassador Herbst said, I think the relevant distinction and the question we should ask ourselves in terms of our policies is not security versus human rights, but short-term versus long-term. Are the policies we're pursuing just about trying to secure some sort of short-term advantage, or are they really key to a longer-term vision of what we want to see in the world? And I think where we often fall down is where we're too focused on short-term issues. You know, an example I'll give of that today is in the fight against ISIS. We're so concerned about making sure that we maintain access to the Incirlik Air Base in Turkey that we might overlook long-term trends there that are actually destabilizing. And so, you know, I think that's always going to be a challenge inherent to a democracy in which you have, you know, members of Congress turn over every 2 years and presidents every 4 years to have a long-term vision. But the further down the road we're looking in terms of identifying our interests and planning our policies, I think the better our policies will be.
Anyone else have questions? Any answer? About anything? How is the food in Tashkent? Okay. I guess I'll. Shall we close it up then? Anybody else? Last minute. Last call. Our closing. All right. One more. Anyway, get one
for Ambassador Herbst. On your trip back, what things were you looking for in terms of, like, the difference from the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I've been reading with great interest what's been happening in Uzbekistan since August of last year. So, you know, I was very keen to talk to people about the changes in policy. And I had that opportunity not just with Uzbeks, but also with Westerners who are, and actually not just Westerners, but others who are resident in Tashkent, representatives of the UN and the international financial institutions, to get a sense of how people see it. And I laid out, you know, what I brought back in my first remarks. And again, the city looked, I mean, Tashkent looks very different than what I saw when I left in July 2003. Many new large roads, many new beautiful buildings. And you have a sense, even on the street, of something's in the air, something's happening. And may that also be proved true.
A wonderful place to leave it. So we'll close it up. I hope everybody has a nice day.
Happy Thanksgiving,
everybody. I'm going to stuff my face. All right. Thank you very much.